So I'm Jen Bleka, and I normally teach at San Francisco State University in the Geography Department. And one of the classes that I've gotten to teach the last few years is called The Geography of Garbage. And it's been a real eye-opener for me. I've learned a lot about where stuff goes. Where does all this stuff go? And so this week is going to be sort of an overview of a lot of issues about our current waste habits, what we waste, and what happens to it when we're done with it, but all with an eye toward how that should make us make different choices about how things are designed, what things we choose to use, and what we should do with them when we're done, which is a bigger rethinking conceptually about our relationship with material objects than just which bin should we throw it in. So today, I'm going to start with a little. Everybody take.
I love props.
Props.
Imagine that if you hang on to it, even for a few seconds, let's say it is made of a very strong acid, and it's going to eat your fingers off. Okay? So, close your eyes and hold your thing, your object, and then at the count of three, it's going to burn your fingers. The acid is going to eat your fingers. So you need to do something with it. Fast. Okay? And in fact, it's such a strong thing that even the fumes of it might kind of burn you a little bit. So if you don't want it in your hand and you kind of don't want it near you, it's kind of scary. Okay. So everybody ready with your piece of scary trash? 3, 2, 1, acid! All right.
Uh-oh. Yeah, burned hands.
Yeah, for sure. So where did they get? Did anybody get hit by a piece of trash? Did anybody get some of the
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I threw it right at me.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, then, look, I have all of this near me.
Yeah, and somebody threw all the stuff at me. You people.
Well, this is just to say, so I'm here, and I didn't even have any trash. I don't even have any in my hand, but now it's all around me. So the point is, perhaps silly, but away from me is closer to somebody else. There is no away. We live on this finite world, right? And there's no away. If we send things south, there's some community or neighborhood or state or country south. If we throw them north, they go north. There's always somebody where we're trying to put it. And even if those somebodies, you know, are polar bears, are other species, our waste doesn't disappear because it's a contained planet. We have contained ecosystems. So there is no really such thing as waste. Sometimes people talk about, what if we send our trash into space? And people have actually seriously suggested that as an option for waste management. It's not very feasible in terms of cost effectiveness of fuel. We have a lot of garbage, and it takes a lot. We can't even get somebody back up to the moon for, you know. So to be hauling, you know, millions and millions and millions, billions of tons of waste and throwing it in space, just, it's not really going to work. So for the time being, anyway, we're pretty much limited to Earth. And wherever we put our garbage, wherever we send it away, is closer to somebody else. So that's part of the geography mindset. Is so if we're sending it somewhere, where is that? And we send our waste a lot of different places now. So everybody here is from a different community, a different city, a different town, rural area, and we have, you know, 1,000 dumps and 1,000 different incinerators and recycling plants and different little pathways for materials goods to travel on after we're done with them. So we can't, there have been a number of interesting books in recent years of people actually tracking their particular trash. A good one that I recommend is Garbage Land by Elizabeth Royd. She lives in New York, and she took a year and actually followed her waste. She followed her sewer pipe to where it goes, and she followed her plastics to where they go, and her glass, and it's pretty interesting, and we could all might do well to investigate what happens after we put it in the bin and somebody takes it away. But for today, I want to do sort of an overview of bigger trends in our waste production and management in the United States in particular, and a little history of garbage, and in the direction of sort of worst practices to best practices. So I always start with the depressing stuff first, and then work toward the good stuff, so we have hope at the end. But I think it's good for us all to have a pretty strong reality-based understanding of where things currently go and what the status is. And how we got to the point that we are now. You know, people have made waste forever, right? Everybody, people, humans, trees make waste. They drop their leaves, right? And if you get mulberry stains on your car or your sidewalk, birds make waste. Living creatures make waste. But we have different waste now, and it's more of a problem now. And we'll get into why that is in a couple minutes. Okay, I'm just going to show a couple slides to just get us more in the mindset about our material lives these days. How many people are familiar with the book Material World by Peter Menzies? He's a photographer who's made a couple really beautiful and interesting coffee table books, one called Material World, another one called Hungry Planet, that do a comparison of sort of the daily life in a lot of different countries. So this book, Material World, he went around to maybe 50 or 60 different countries and found an average family for that country. So if this country, the average family has 5 children and makes $10,000 a year and lives in a 2-bedroom house, and they found a family that fit that complete average. And they went to another, you know, country where the average was 9 kids and makes $3,000. Or another country where people have 1 kid and make $60,000. And they would find a family that fit that description. If that country is more rural, they found a rural family. If the country, the average is urban, they found an urban family. And then what they did was ask that family to bring every single material object that they own out in front of their house and take a picture of it. Everything they own. And so what you get are these portraits. So Material World by Peter Menzel. And I, out of the 60, I took a selection of just 5 or 6 examples. So here is a family, the Natomo family from Mali. And in his family, the father's 39, he has 2 wives and 8 kids. What do they have here?
They have a mortar and pestle, grinded grain. They have some pots. They have 2 chairs, looks like, a few cooking implements, a couple of chickens, a bicycle.
A little bit.
It does point out that not included in the photo, there are a few other possessions not included in the photo. Another mortar and pestle, 2 wooden mattress platforms, 30 mango trees, and old radio batteries that the children use as toys. The total fertility rate, the average is 7 children per woman, and the infant mortality rate is unfortunately very high, so probably not all of their 8 kids will grow up. But that's their house and what they have. Here is this rural Indian family. The mother is 25, they have 4 kids. She cooks over a wooden fire. Her husband works about 56 hours a week, and they sometimes go a couple weeks at a time with very little food. So you see they have a bed, they have some sacks of grain, again a bicycle, and some cooking implements, and a few pieces of like bedding and cloth, kind of thing, towels. Okay, so here in China, we have a 9-member extended family, the grandparents, parents, and kids. They don't have a TV, but they do get news through 2 radios and the family's most prized possession, a television. They hope to get, in the future, a VCR, a fridge, and drugs to combat the diseases in the carp they raise. Not in the photo are there 100 mandarin orange trees, a vegetable patch, and 3 pigs. So they have you know, more stuff, for sure. If you want to get into the details, the book is really interesting. It says that it gives a complete list of every single thing a family has. So now in Japan, small houses, very full of things. They have 2 daughters and a dog. They have a lot of electronic items. Their most cherished possessions are a ring and heirloom pottery. But they have a washing machine and dryer, piano, a lot of stuff like that. Okay. And then in the U.S., this family in Texas has a 1,600 square foot house in a cul-de-sac in Pearland, Texas, a suburb of Houston. The father used to be a firefighter. So to get the picture, photographers hoisted the family up in a cherry picker because they couldn't get everything in the view. Still not pictured are the refrigerator, freezer, camcorder, woodworking tools, computer, glass butterfly collection, trampoline, fishing equipment, and the rifles Rick uses for deer hunting, among other things. Though rich with possessions, nothing is as important to the Skeens as their Bible. For this devoutly Baptist family, the book says, it is a spiritual rather than material life that matters most. So there they are with their Bible. All right. So with this picture, I mean, we can start to... This book now was written about 15 years ago. And in that time, the average house size has continued to grow. The average amount of consumption has continued to grow, and the average amount of waste that we produce has continued to grow. And we start to think about, you know, how big are our houses, and does our life look like that? Is that a typical American house and home and life with, you know, bicycles and beds and pianos and photos and refrigerators and, yeah, probably so. Probably most of us in this room can claim a number of those things. And a 1,600 square foot house just isn't that big anymore in the US. That's a pretty, you know, medium. So I just show those to kind of get us in the mind frame of thinking that what we see around us and what we have and what our neighbors have and the kinds of things that we buy and sleep on and use and every day isn't just natural. It's not average and it's not normal. It's a recent thing and it's an unusual thing in the world, the amount of stuff that we have. And what is our relationship to it? So, there's our stuff. So I'd like to talk just a little and tell a couple stories, really, about waste for the 20th century, because, like I said, people have always had waste. So we have human waste. There's sewage. That needs to be managed. And when people used to live in very small groups of people, moving from place to place, it wasn't that big a deal because it just never kind of built up. So you could go in the woods, and then, you know, a few weeks later, your group of 12 people, when you're a, you know, foraging person, a hunter-gatherer or something, you just move on, and no problem. But as people started living in one place permanently and started getting larger settlements, then stuff kind of starts building up. And in fact, when agriculture started, permanent settled agriculture, when people started living in one place and using the same fields over and over and making villages of people who lived there permanently, it was a real problem that brought diseases. And it was one of the causes of the life expectancy of human beings dropping by like half from the relatively high life expectancy when people moved from place to place. Life expectancy was like 60 or 70 years. And when they got permanent settled agriculture, it became 30, 35 years because of the diseases that came with piles of garbage. So the rats came, and the fleas came, and the lice came, and they carried diseases. So waste has been a problem for a while. But again, it really depended on the size of the settlement. In the last few hundred or few thousand years, as big cities developed, it got really bad in the cities. Rome figured out a sewer. And that was one of the reasons that Rome was able to become so strong and last a long time, was because not everybody died of diseases because they got their human waste to go down a tube. And that was a major innovation. But most cities actually didn't develop sewers until the 20th century. And so cities like London and New York and Edinburgh and Paris and Boston and were just filled with filth. And they had to figure out ways to try to get it out. Because not only was there human waste, there were all kinds of other waste too. So there's, like today, food waste. I mean, there are potato peels and stuff like that. There's the human waste. There's horse and cow waste. Until the 20th century, you had to keep the cows in the city, because if you had the cows way out in the country, by the time you got the milk to town, it would have spoiled, because there wasn't refrigerated transport. So in 1910, there were still tens of thousands of cows living in London. There were thousands of cows living in New York. There were thousands of cows living in Chicago, because until they got refrigerated rail transport, you had to have them nearby or the milk would spoil. So what do you do with all the cow manure? Also, it was horse transport. So there were tens of thousands of horses living in all these big cities, hauling the milk and hauling people and hauling goods back and forth. And they make a lot of manure. 30, 50 pounds of manure per house per horse per day. And if you have a couple hundred thousand horses, you suddenly have millions of pounds of manure a day, plus all the other kinds of garbage. So I was going to mention that in the late 1890s, there got to be this real like panic in New York that the city was actually going to become uninhabitable because of horse manure. It was piling up on the sides of the streets so high that you could hardly carry out commerce or walk. And so they had to bring in more carts to try to haul it out. Haul it out. Thousands of carts hauling horse manure out of the city every day. But what were those carts pulled by? Horses. So you had to bring in thousands more horses to haul out the horse manure. And each of those horses contributed. And so they were just, it was like a feedback loop that people couldn't even comprehend. They thought really by like 1910, we can't have New York anymore. It is covered in horse manure. And then automobiles came and it was the end of the horse manure crisis. But throughout the 1800s, there was not like municipal garbage pickup. So people would take their garbage from, you know, rotten food or potato peelings or whatever, and you threw them out your window. You had your night soil, human waste. You had your potty that you went in at night in your tenement, and in the morning you'd open the window, out it goes. I actually heard, I don't know if this is true, I haven't ever had it confirmed, but we think that the word loo, they go into the loo, comes from in the old days in England and Scotland, before you throw your night soil out the window, you're supposed to say, watch out! And they wanted to make it a little pretty, so they were using French, and they said, garde-loo, which is watch out for the, would you say it in French?
Garde-loo.
Yeah. Watch out for the water. Right? So, garde-loo, and they throw their human waste out the window. So there's that. So one of the waste systems in 19th century cities was hogs. In Manhattan, there were upwards of 100,000 hogs roaming the streets, feral, eating garbage. They eat human waste. They eat dead rats, dead dogs, kitchen trimmings. They eat some manure of other animals. They eat a lot of stuff. And they actually reduced the garbage problem in New York in most neighborhoods considerably. It would have been unbearable without the hogs. Starting in the 1820s, then through the 1840s and 50s, some of the captains of industry and commerce were starting to think that having hogs roaming the streets eating garbage was unsightly. It also was disruptive for commerce because they would root up the cobblestones with their noses, and it made it hard for like wagons to get through. And they would run and knock people over. And so you couldn't have like ladies come to town. You couldn't have upper class people walking around, you know, with their like top hats and whatever, and like pigs knock them over and trip. So they decided to kind of cordon off a certain part of Lower Manhattan as a hog-free zone. And so they sent in these hog catchers with hog carts, and they were trying to remove the hogs. But the poor people fought back. And it's known as the hog riots of the 1820s, 1830s, 1840s. The poor people were like, oh, you are not taking our pigs, because that is excellent protein. You know, they didn't use protein, they didn't know about protein. They were like, that's meat. That's meat. We don't get enough to eat down here, and you're not taking our meat. Because every couple months, we kill one of them and we eat it because it's delicious and it's great food, and you rich people can't take our pigs away. And so they went out with pitchforks and clubs and stuff, and they would grab the hog catchers and tie them up and throw them in their own hog catching cart and hit the horse and off they'd run. So the poor people actually kept the hog catchers away for a couple decades. But after a cholera epidemic, 1849, another cholera epidemic, 1859, they were like, okay. They didn't have germ theory, they didn't know what the cholera was coming from, but there was this general feeling that it might have something to do with filth and pigs. So they were kind of like, okay, take our pigs. I guess we don't want cholera. So they sent in the hog catchers, and in the 1850s, they removed something like 60,000 pigs from Lower Manhattan, and they got a pig-free zone up to 49th Street, pig-free zone up to 59th Street, pig-free zone finally in all of Manhattan. And then they went to Brooklyn and did the same thing. But once the pigs were gone, they still had this problem of all this garbage and all this manure and all this stuff, and it just would pile up and stink and bad. So what do you do? Well, another thing that was going on for waste management was the farmers. So at this time, Brooklyn and Queens were agricultural. Rich agricultural, best soil on the whole east half of the country. And they grew all sorts of vegetables and food for Manhattan. And so the farmers would come in every morning with a cart full of vegetables, and they'd drop them off. And then they would fill up their whole cart with manure and garbage and take it back to their farm and put it on the soil. And so that was another means to haul garbage out of the city. Still, it wasn't enough, so it was piling up. So finally, this sanitary movement of the late 1800s, people really still didn't understand about germs, but they just had this feeling that these piles of garbage were not healthful. They had the miasma or miasma theory that this stuff was making dirt float in the air and the fumes were making people sick. So some sort of progressive, forward-thinking people decided that the city should get cleaner. So they actually, in 1895, they hired the first citywide chief of sanitation. And he was actually a military colonel from the Civil War, Colonel George Waring. And he was organized. So he hired many, many men and devised pickup routes and sweeping and barrels and a whole system of sorting into these three bins and regular pickup routes and getting the stuff out of there and having clean streets. And one of the famous things was he had all the garbage men dressed in white uniforms, white cap, white jacket, white pants, white from head to toe, and they were known as Colonel Waring's White Wings. And it was to associate them with cleanliness and health, and so that people would want them to come on their street and help them because they were going to make New York like this healthy, clean place to live. And they would parade them in every city parade, like thousands of them, and they're all marching in their white uniforms. And it really worked. They did it, and they like got the garbage out, and they were super efficient and kind of military in their plan of cleanliness. And at that time, Colonel Waring had, devised this three-bin system. There were three kinds of garbage, three kinds of waste at that time, so late 1890s. What do you suppose the three bins were?
Well, human waste.
You know what? That was actually handled separate. That wasn't in their, thing. Huh, that's interesting. Okay.
Because they were doing sewers.
Yeah, they managed sewers by then, I think.
Food waste?
Yes.
Animal waste.
That's part of the same one.
Oh.
How did people heat their homes?
Cookers.
And what kind of waste do you get from that?
Ash.
And if you get all the food and wet organic waste out, and you separate your ash, what other kinds of things do people throw out?
Not much then, because they fixed everything.
Mm-hmm. They did fix everything.
Mm-hmm. But if something wasn't fixable, you know, it could be.
Yeah. It's called rubbish, garbage, and ash. Ash was a very large part of the stream. Anybody remember from The Great Gatsby, the ash piles and T.J. Eckelberg's eyes looking over these giant piles of ash? Anybody? Ninth grade, Great Gatsby. Anyway, they made these mountains of ash. Garbage and rubbish. So garbage is to rot. Animal waste, food waste, human waste, any kind of wet, nasty, rotty stuff. And then, like the slaughterhouses, that went into garbage. And actually, in the field today, garbage still refers to, technically, garbage is like rottable organics. Rubbish was pieces of cloth, buttons, paper, tin, pretty much everything that would go in a recycling bin today. So it was dry, and it was kind of uniform pieces of materials from different families of material, glass, metal, paper, cloth. So those were their three bins. Other places, so this model kind of caught on, and other cities were like, have you been to New York lately? You can walk on the sidewalk. Whoa, we should do that here. So cities started kind of spreading this idea of like, you know what, we could send trucks around regularly and pick up stuff. And then it wouldn't pile up. That'd be a really good idea. So this concept of sort of unified, regular waste pickup and hauling away really spread to a lot of cities. And by the 1810s, 1820s, a lot of cities had this. And it often was done by, on a small scale, a lot of times immigrant families in San Francisco, which I know some about the, it was mostly Italian families, and they would have a truck that had like an open back, and it would have 10 or 15 bins on the back. And they would separate everything at the time. You'd put your bins up, and they would get it up there, and then they would go through it. Just like, how many people here have done garbo duty? Okay, about half. Just like that. You get out there and you're like, bone, 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 tin, tin, paper, paper, cloth, cloth, bin, you know, dead animal. You know, they had all their containers so that they could then fill them up and then drive and say, okay, here I have white glass, blue glass, green glass, brown glass, tin, the iron, and they could sell all those things. And that was their income because people didn't pay them to pick up. They got paid by what they could sell the thing for.
And that was in, did you say, was that in
that's San Francisco.
1920s?
Teens, 20s?
Of this, zeros, of the last century.
Of the 1900s.
Okay.
Right. So what they were doing was source separation. They separated it right at the point of disposal. And then everything, the more categories they could separate it into, then it was more saleable. And as somebody mentioned, like they didn't throw much away. In the 1800s, there's some very interesting histories of trash making out now. I actually have a resource guide here, but Waste and Want by Susan Strasser is an amazing story of how we have sort of been taught to waste throughout the 19th century in these young ladies' schools of the late 1800s, early 1900s. They actually have records of the class plan of, you know, so they taught them sewing and deportment and how to set a table and these nice things. And they said, and how, here's our class on how to use a waste bin. This is a trash can. And the question is, well, what do you put in it? Because the girls didn't know what on earth you would put into this thing. Because what they had always had, you know, when their mothers and their grandmothers taught them, well, the grease you save to make soap, and the worn-out clothes you save to make kids' clothes, and then rags, and then, you know, and the buttons you save for when you sew new clothes, and the paper is pretty rare, you don't really have very much because that was super expensive. Rags go to the rag man because they make that into paper, and you can trade it for tin goods. We had to be taught to make garbage in many cases. What would we put in a trash can? Because they would put it under the, you know, in the girls' dormitory rooms, and there was like nothing in it. And they're like, to be a civilized lady, you need to put things into your trash bin. So, okay, so 20th century. Yeah, these first couple decades, there was municipal trash collection and source separation. They divided things out into many different categories, each of which then could be recycled or go into use. Oh, I should say, back in New York, when they started separating the garbage and the rubbish and the ash, so the garbage, they would take this, I mean, it's so disgusting to think about, but I mean, it had medical waste, it had slaughterhouse waste, and all this ick, right? And they would take it and boil it, and they would skim off the fat and squeeze it, and the fat was used, all those greases mixed together was used for industrial lubricants and for soap making, and it was not put to waste. And then the rest, after the fats were skimmed off, they would squeeze the rest and make it into cakes and bake them. And then that was sometimes used for fertilizer, or in some cases for animal feed and different things. But none of the garbage portion of the waste was put to waste, actually, and the rubbish also was sorted. The rubbish got taken to Staten Island, where there was actually a resident community of about 800 people, mostly African-American and Irish, I believe, who lived there. I mean, they like raised their kids. They were not there seasonally. They were there all year round, and every day barges would come up with all the rubbish, which would come onto docks, and they would sort it by hand, and again, sell all those different things. That was how they did it in New York. That operation was eventually replaced by the world's biggest landfill, Fresh Chase, which went on. Yeah.
Did local government play any role in the kind of the initial process of the garbage collection?
Yeah. In many cases, I mean, in New York, it did. New York made a centralized plan. At least Manhattan made a centralized plan and hired the Stuart Waring to clean the streets of the city.
Okay.
And then other cities, had to figure out, they saw that and they were like, we want our city to be clean and modern and stuff too. So some of them.
Didn't pay for it?
It differs by city. So some cities would make a contract with one, but back then there weren't any big waste haulers. It was really like every family would have a truck. So like the city of Milwaukee didn't really contract with a family because it just wasn't big enough. But as the 20th century went on, these things, like some of them got bigger and it got involved with mafia and it got to be a big ring and a racket and the big companies and stuff. So then some of those have turned into like waste management. So, and other ones have gone out of business. Most cities now have one or two haulers, and some cities, a lot of cities have a contract with one waste hauler. But back then, as I understand it, and you can inform me more, but as I understand it, it was not like the New York system was rare in its citywide organization and central planning. Most cities had more like small companies kind of patchworked over the course of the city. But they wanted it to happen, so they must have done something with taxes or laws or encouragements of some kind to like bring those into or organization. Like, okay, we'll build the landfill, and then y'all can have lots of different companies and come dump in it or something like that.
Yeah.
So that's a piece I'm not very fully informed about. So then a big change happened. And what time is it?
It's 20 till.
Oh my goodness. Okay, this was supposed to be the intro. a big change happened after World War II. Where most of the garbage from cities had been going was a dump, a landfill, which in many cases were just a low spot. Often a wetland, marsh, shoreline. A lot of cities, New York, San Francisco, Seattle, just about every city used garbage between the 20s to the 50s, used it as a land reclamation thing. You fill in low areas and you get more land to build on. So a large portion of San Francisco's land didn't used to be there. It's 50 feet deep of trash that they squashed into the bay and then they built over. New York also has large portions of land, hundreds of acres that didn't used to be there, but they put 10 years truckloads worth of garbage out there and squashed it down and then built on it. So that's where some of it went. And so for 20 or 30 years there, there was this post-war bonanza of waste making because landfills were really cheap. You could dump stuff in a landfill for almost nothing. And they, in order to just make that happen quickly, they invented compactor trucks. No longer did you have trucks with lots of bins in the back that things had to be sorted into. You had one truck, and you'd throw everything in there, and it would and squash it, right? And then you could put more in and squash it, and everything would get crushed. And then when it was really full, you'd take it and dump it in the landfill. And so the technology of the compactor truck and the landfill were just like hand in hand how the United States, anyway, approached our garbage management from like the 50s into the 70s, let's say. So, what's been interesting in the last 30 years or so is we've started to cycle back to some of the things from before then about sorting out the recyclables and trying to not crush everything and not send everything right to the landfill, but to keep the garbage and the rubbish and the
We don't have so much ash. But to
plastic.
Keep our, yeah, our plastic separate. So there's really some interesting ways in which our current waste management habits look more like the 20s than they do the 50s, or at least in some communities they should. We're going in that direction. Okay. So, okay, here is a question. Now here we are in the 21st century, and comparing the waste that we make now with, say, 150 years ago. What about our habits of garbage making now? What about them is problematic? Why might we worry more about our garbage now than they did in 1850? What's different now? Well, a lot of people. Okay, I'll start here.
Doesn't decompose.
It doesn't decompose.
A lot more people.
More people.
More toxic.
More toxic.
We don't try to fix anything. We just, like, we have an iPod, it's broken. Oh, we're just going to throw it away and buy a new one.
Mm-hmm. Less space.
Less space.
We're using up our resources and we realize that by now. We didn't realize that by now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, we thought it was unlimited. Unlimited.
And we realize the impact on the rest of the world.
That too. Yeah.
We make more weirder things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, Happy Meal toys.
Yeah.
There was Happy Meal toys in
barber shop.
Right.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I often, so my little formula here, and you hit on all of them. All of those things are true, and I usually compress them into like three big categories: population, or consumption habits, and the type of trash. So our population has gone way up and is still going up. So by sheer numbers, if we even made the same amount of trash and the same kind of trash that we made 150 years ago, it'd still be a problem because there are so many of us. Also, like the more urbanized we are, if you have millions of people living in the city together, it piles up really fast. We're not all spread out rurally in the world. So because we have a huge and growing population and we're clumped up, that is a problem making in the world of trash. Our consumption habits. Each of us uses more stuff than our counterparts of 150 years ago. We go through stuff. We you know, it used to be use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. And now we're like, disposal! Use it once, throw it out, swimmers, just, you know, everything. Disposable camera, disposable mop, disposable. We're supposed to just use stuff once and then chuck it. Which is different. We just go through more stuff. And then several of you mentioned the types of things that we make. We make things that are non-biodegradable and toxic. Non-biodegradable and toxic. So we have things that will sit around for a long time and they poison us and they poison other people and they poison the soil and the air and the animals and the water. So we have a lot of people making toxic waste that's going to last a long time, and we make a lot of it each. So these are like the three big categories that worry me about trash these days. So population is its whole own topic, which we're not really going to get into. But our consumption habits and rates and the types of trash that we make are going to be sort of the topics of the rest of the week. So just to give you a little preview, tomorrow is going to be focused pretty much on plastics. What do we use plastic for? What are the good things about them? What are the bad things about them? Where do they go? How much should we worry about them? What should we use instead? Should we be using something else instead? So tomorrow is plastics. Wednesday is electronic waste, e-waste. So those are two worrisome types of trash in terms of their longevity and toxicity. And then Friday is mostly about our habits of consumption, the things that push us to buy and use up and throw out, and how we can think about our relationship with material resources differently. Okay, so today
I do want to make sure we get through sort of the main things, like the lower archy of what we can do with our waste. So what do we do, this is in the US, what do we do with our trash today? So in the US, the latest 2010 figures are we bury over half of it in landfills. We burn about 12% of it in incinerators that then do produce electricity. So some people feel that that's a good thing to do because it's not just going in a hole, it's making electricity. Okay. We recycle about 34%, which is way up. I will argue that the order in which we do things should be reversed, that reduce is the best, reuse is next. Recycle should be sort of the last resort. And then those should sort of, you know, we should try to get them just off the table. But that's what we currently do. And that differs by region. So on the East Coast, red is incineration. And so there's a lot more waste to energy incineration than in the West. We don't have very many incinerators. We don't do that very much. Minnesota incinerates 20%. There's a big incinerator in Minneapolis. But out here we mostly landfill or recycle. And it differs a lot by region. It's a cultural thing, it's a priority thing, it's finances, how it all works. I know that do people know the term diversion rate? Diversion rate? Okay, so if, say this is a graph of your total municipal solid waste, MSW, I should write bigger, right? MSW is municipal solid waste. This is everything that people throw away and that businesses throw in the trash in a town, let's say. So if this is 100% of it, the amount that you can pick out to go to recycling or composting is called what you divert. So the assumption is that this goes to a landfill. But if you can divert 10% or divert 50%, that would keep 50% of it out of a landfill, right? I'll just say that it's radically different from place to place. In California, which I know the best at the moment, about in the mid-90s, the California State Legislature set as a goal that every municipality in California by 2000 needed to be at a 25% diversion rate. Every municipality needed to get 25% of their trash from going in the landfill. Recycle it, compost it, whatever. You need to get up to 25. At the same time, San Francisco said, by 2000, we can get 50. It's a 50% diversion rate. So both of those happened. San Francisco got to 50, and the state of California got to 25. Also in that same legislation, it said, and by 2010, the whole state of California, every municipality in California needs to get to 50% diversion rate. And San Francisco said, we can do 75. And in fact, they did. So now in 2012, San Francisco has a 78% diversion rate. Only 22% of their municipal solid waste goes to a landfill. Whoa.
Is the vast majority of that recycling?
It's pretty even. It's, a lot of it is recycling, and a lot of it is compost. San Francisco, they like restaurants. They like to eat. They don't have yards. So they don't have very much yard waste at all, but they have a ton of food waste. So they found that they could only get to about here, 50% with recycling. And they're like, what is the next biggest chunk that we can do? We have to do compost. We have to sort. We have to have organics. So they added a third bin. So now they have a black bin for landfill, a blue bin for recyclables, and a green bin for organic waste. And you can put pizza boxes, napkins, Q-tips, used Kleenexes, milk cartons, and all the food waste and bones and cheese and every kind of thing that came from a plant or an animal.
What has happened to the poundage per person over the same time? You talk about percentages, but
poundage per person where's my little, I have this somewhere here. Oh, I'm going backward. So our waste, where's my waste chart? Hopefully we'll get to it. Our national amount of garbage that we throw out has continued to go up. It slowed down quite a bit between 2000 and 2010. In fact, it peaked in about 2005, and it's gone down to tiny bit since 2005, as has our per person waste output. It's gone up like, and then right at about 2005, it kind of has leveled off between 2005 and 2010. So at least it's not like, it's peaking a little bit.
It's because of the recession.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I think so. That's an excellent point. I think so. So while San Francisco has gotten to a 78% diversion rate, I know the people from San Francisco, I have them come talk in my class, the managers of this San Francisco Environment Department, and they'll say, you know, it really is, there's a cultural thing and a historical thing and what the city prides, that like, the city thinks of itself as like a green city and whatever. So they said, well, let's just compare with Houston, for example. Houston has a similar per capita income, I guess, similar size, similar education levels. What do you think the diversion rate is in Houston?
78. Houston also has a lot more land around it.
One of the big drivers for cities to up their diversion rates is when you start running out of landfill space, or when landfills get really expensive. So even 15, 20 years ago, it often cost $18 a ton. They call it a tipping fee. When you drive your garbage truck up to a landfill and say, I want to dump my garbage truck in your landfill, they say $18 a ton, and so you pay your tipping fee and you get to tip your truck in. In the Bay Area now, it's about $120 a ton. So you could save a lot of money by not dumping your trash in a landfill. Brian, who's teaching the other class at this time, who teaches at Pacific Lutheran University, said the university figured out a couple of years ago that, they had been talking about, well, we should compost, it would be a good thing to do. And then somebody finally sat down and did like a cost audit of the weight of all the food waste and organic waste on campus and how much weight that would take out of their garbage dumping and the tipping fees that they pay. And so they switched to, they compost all the food waste on campus and they save hundreds of thousands of dollars a year by composting. So where are we? So nationally, you know, this is a good trend. We've gone from this is the compactor truck and cheap landfill era. People didn't, there was no incentive to recycle. It's largely an economic thing. And now as landfill tipping prices have gone up, it's harder to site landfills and it's harder to build a new one. The prices have gone up, and so more cities give more incentive to recycle instead. So this is the percentage of our total municipal waste that get recycled in the U.S. these days.
Does that include industrial waste? Because
this is municipal solid waste, which is pretty much post-consumer.
There's a lot more industrial waste, right?
Correct.
Than municipal anyways.
Right.
Okay. That's probably a different topic.
That's a topic that's coming in just a second, which is municipal waste is the tip of the waste berg. People who study this see that for every product that we buy, this pen, this piece of paper, a pair of shoes, on average, in the whole U.S., for every pound of product that we buy at a store that gets used by a consumer, 70 to 90 pounds of waste are created upstream. The mining, the logging, the extraction of the coal, and then the production of steel and the production of aluminum and the energy that has to go into it and the trimmings and the whatever. 70 to 90 pounds of waste are created for every pound of the actual garbage that we throw out in a bin. So that's why, we can fuss about this, but that's why I say reduction is absolutely most important. If you can prevent 1 pound of stuff from coming into your life and going out your back door, you've prevented 70 pounds of waste. So it's less important which bin you put your 1 pound in than not making the 70 pounds in the first place. So just think what an impact the act of, you know what, I don't need that. You just saved, you know, 70 pounds by not needing that new mug or that new, you know, shirt or whatever. It's that has the biggest impact of all. So in fact, when we, I think it's a good piece of advice I read or heard somewhere to take away. Those of us who care and are trying to be, you know, thoughtful and mindful and everything can get really caught up and worked up and like bound even by like, oh, what do I do with this? Okay, what about bottle caps? I mean, they're metal, but they have like a little plastic lining in there, or like the envelope with window, or with dental floss. Is it made of cotton? Is it, but it's wax? But if it, oh, and we can like sit there and like carry this like bottle cap around. I don't know which bin. I'm gonna have to ask somebody. It's like, just throw the stinking bottle cap away. Don't worry about it. It's so small. Write a letter. Like, get your tires pumped up. Get your house insulated. Take the 10 minutes that you would take to figure out where to throw your bottle cap and write a letter to a company or a member of Congress or your state or the letter to the editor.
Or don't buy the soda.
Don't buy the soda.
Next time, don't buy the soda.
Right. And use your time and energy and mental capacity. I mean, do the low-hanging fruit. Like, you know, spend the 80% of your time. You know, put your, you know, recycling in the recycle bin and, you know, try to reduce your trash and compost your compost or whatever. Do put the some effort into doing like those big things. Set up your bins and tell your names. But then the little tiny things, the amount of mental energy it takes to solve those things, it might be better spent going back to tackle bigger problems and try to change sort of systemic things.
It's 5.
It is 5 o'clock or is it 5 minutes?
It's 5 o'clock.
5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. You got another hour to talk to us. You got to reschedule the rest of it.
And tonight,
part
after
two.
Dinner.
Goodness gracious.
So is composting taking hold kind of across the country, or?
Yeah.
Like in the Twin Cities, they don't. You know, you don't do your composting thing out on the curb like you do your recycles and all that.
It's coming.
Good.
It's coming.
In Portland, they just made it so garbage only gets picked up every other week.
Woohoo!
And
nice.
Compost gets picked up every week.
Woohoo!
That's great.
Seattle is doing curbside pickup of compost now. Portland is doing curbside pickup. San Francisco does curbside pickup. I do 17 different municipalities in the Bay Area. It's coming. And if you ask for it, it will come faster. And it's brilliant. It takes a huge chunk out of this. You know, and it changes depending on where you live. If you are in a place with big yards, then there's more yard waste and less food waste, but most places have a pretty big chunk that could be handled by organics collection. Now, if you live in a rural area or a really far dispersed area, it makes more sense to do home composting. Have your own bin, or if you, you know, have a worm bin, or a, you know, figure out some local solution, because driving the diesel trucks around everywhere to collect your banana peels to take them somewhere else to compost them is
stupid.
in a word. stupid, inefficient. But if you live in a dense place where not everybody is going to or wants to, or there are a lot of apartment buildings and it's not feasible to have everybody have a compost bin in their yard, compost collection is a fabulous thing. San Francisco, again, for example, hauls all this compost out about an hour away, which is not very efficient. It's a lot of diesel, but they take it out there and they compost it, and in about 80 days, about 3 months, 2 to 3 months, they have beautiful certified organic soil that gets sold to Napa Valley vineyards. It's they buy it, and the city pays for pretty much the whole composting collection distribution program by the income that they get from selling this compost. It's beautiful stuff.
Can you certify it to be organic if it's
I have the same question.
Just dumping in?
They do, the process that they use for the composting, they're very, very high end about like the temperatures and the fluffing and the turning and everything. And the organic certification people come out and test it all the time, and they do not find levels of anything that they're worried about. So, yeah, it's five, so everybody feel free. So, yeah. I guess we will not have time for this. I was going to get into how a landfill works and how incinerator works.
Seriously,
you
should do
pros and cons of all that.
Yeah.
Add it on.
Say in a nutshell how a landfill works.
Well, yeah.
Show your picture.
What picture?
Don't you have a picture of a landfill?
Oh, I have landfills and incinerators and can talk all about
that. Yeah, but we promised us home at the end. I guess you deliver it to
it. Here, I'll show you the picture of the plant. Here. What we really should be doing isn't that clever? That's a toilet paper tube.
Oh, that is clever.
There we go.
Clever. Nice. So reuse and reduction and recycling. And we also, lots of things. But, okay, I'll have to work this in tomorrow. All right. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.